What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Well, I'm talking to you. We're entertainment, right? What do you got for us?
Well, what do you want to get for it? Do you expect to be paid? Because...
I don't want to be paid. I don't need to be paid. Look, I'm here with my partner and 9 other people. See, we're dying, man. You know? You're going to see our brains on a sidewalk. They're going to spill our guts out. Now, you're going to show that on television? Have all your housewives look at that? Instead of as the world turns? I mean, what do you got for me? I want something for that.
As far as hostage takers go, one of the more sympathetic in movie history, Al Pacino's Sonny from 1975's Dog Day Afternoon. This week, here's the deal. You give us your attention, we give you our top 5 hostage movies.
And we want a private jet to Mexico.
Let's not push our luck, Josh.
Right. Our hostage movies top 5 is inspired by Captain Phillips, the new film from Paul Greengrass starring Tom Hanks. Our review and more.
I'm dying here.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 1 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM1013. That's offer code FILM1013. You're listening to Film Spotting. Later in the show, we'll parse the differences between a kidnapping movie in a hostage movie that's coming up in the Film Spotting Top 5.
But first, Adam and I had planned to go sailing around the Horn of Africa, you know, for some film spotting bonding time. But then we saw the trailer for Captain Phillips.
Everything okay?
I don't like the look of that.
They're coming in fast.
This is Mask, Alabama.
We are an unarmed freighter. We have 2 skiffs approaching with armed intruders.
Potential piracy situation.
Copy, Alabama. You should alert your crew and get your fire hoses ready.
Is that it?
Chances are it's just fishermen.
They're not here to fish.
Despite my spirited Masquer Theater performances, Adam, I'm not always a capital A acting kind of guy.
I've noticed.
I tend to resist any performance that easily lends itself to an Oscar clip shown during the Academy Awards broadcast. Case in point would be David O. Russell's The Fighter. I bristled a bit at all the hysterical Oscar-nominated performances in that film, and instead most appreciated Mark Wahlberg, who quietly played a real person in the corner.
And then there was me, who didn't much care for Christian Bale or Melissa Leo, and really didn't like Mark Wahlberg, so.
That makes sense, though. Of course you'd go that way. I may have to rethink this whole strategy, though, after Captain Phillips, the latest docudrama from United 93 director Paul Greengrass, about the 2009 hijacking of an American container ship by Somali pirates. Tom Hanks plays the title character, and he's very Tom Hanksian in the movie's first 2/3. Everyday, but compelling, instantly empathetic. The performance gets much more interesting as the movie comes to a close, I'd say, in ways that I hope we can talk about fairly freely, given that the plot follows previously reported events. Essentially, the developments allow Hanks to go to 2 places that we haven't seen him go very often. Phillips becomes completely unhinged at one point, and then later appears utterly defeated, totally hopeless, completely vulnerable. These are big moments. They're very loud, they're hugely dramatic, and I'm sure they're going to show up during the Oscar telecast next year. But I found them hugely compelling and even overwhelming. Now, I know you like to psychoanalyze my reactions to movies a bit, Adam, so put me on the couch here, help me out. Am I softening on this resistance to such performances, or is there something particularly impressive about Hank's performance that may have mesmerized me?
I think it's probably the latter. I think there is probably something mesmerizing about what Tom Hanks is doing here. And it's true, sometimes much to my dismay, you tend to really recoil at what you consider big performances. And we've had this discussion before. Sometimes what you consider a big performance, I don't see as big at all. We really just have 2 different gauges for what qualifies as capital A acting. And I know you are kind of a low-key guy, but Josh, other than the moments you're referring to that we'll get to in a minute, I'm not sure how you could really classify this Tom Hanks performance as big in any way. I think 90% of his lines are probably delivered with a monotone.
Yeah, I'd agree. It makes a really drastic shift toward
that
end.
His usual face, his typical face in this movie, I think could probably be best described as stoic. So that's really what he's playing with here. And he's very restrained, as I think Tom Hanks usually is in dramatic roles, very composed. He lets his presence and his words and his actions carry their weight. And there's always a pleasure in movies, especially, I think, Josh, if you're watching a Michael Mann movie or going back a bit, you're watching a Howard Hawks movie, watching people do their jobs and watching them do their jobs well. And this Captain Phillips is clearly knowledgeable and experienced, and he's quick on his feet, and he leads by example. His men do seem to respect him, even though he's got a new crew here, maybe because he doesn't seem to really care if they respect him or not. He is just going to do his job and do it well. And I did appreciate watching that. I appreciated watching him work. But more than that, beyond his sense of duty, there is, you use the word vulnerable, I would say even in some of those quieter moments, and even as he's doing his job well, you really do get that sense of vulnerability lying beneath Hanks's performance. He's legitimately scared when it's time to be legitimately scared, and Hanks doesn't back down from reflecting those moments in his face or in his physicality. But overall, going back to your first question, there's zero scenery chewing here from my perspective. And as much as I like him for all the reasons I've stated, and I like how restrained he is, the fact is, I have to confess that the movie never really fully engaged me as much as I wanted it to until the very end. And not the big action finale, but the beats right after it, which mostly rely on close-ups of Tom Hanks's face. That's where the movie finally really grabbed me and I was riveted to what I was watching. Unfortunately, it was the end of the movie.
I'm completely with you. This may be the first time we're in lockstep, because I had a similar reaction, would have come away with a positive review, but not that enthusiastic, appreciated certain things about it, Hanks' performance being one of them. And the final, maybe it's 8 minutes even, is when this movie elevated for me. It progressively gets that way, probably a little bit earlier, I'd say, when he is taken hostage on this lifeboat by the pirates. So they're away from the container ship. He's all alone at this point. And that situation gets increasingly desperate. And you can see the performance start to ratchet up there. Mm-hmm. And I would say that moment where he gives up hope in that sequence is where the movie starts to elevate for me. And then it goes to a completely another level in those final scenes where we really see, I mean, this isn't going to be Under Siege, you know, Die Hard on a boat, but
no.
But most Hollywood movies, this is an action movie, okay? It's essentially an action movie. And so usually when we get something like this, we see the hero triumph in some way. Even Die Hard, which we both love, ends with the triumph of the hero. This film really ends with, although he is safe and we get that narrative closure, it ends with a broken down man who can barely even comprehend that he's just been saved. That is a rarity in films like this.
And it takes your breath away. It really does.
It really does. And maybe more so because we see it so rarely than because of how hugely powerful the moment itself is. But I think Hanks really kills it in
that
scene.
Four pirates on board. Four pirates coming towards us down the main deck.
Lock down the bridge.
Yeah.
Listen up. We have been boarded by four armed pirates. You know the drill.
We stay hidden no matter what. I don't want any hostages.
We stay locked down until help arrives. No one comes out until you hear the non-duress password from me, which is supper time.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film starring Tom Hanks, directed by Paul Greengrass. It's called Captain Phillips. And Greengrass is one of these filmmakers. I'm a big fan of many of his films. He excels with procedurals. He's really good at getting into process, especially when it comes to real life events. I believe it was his debut film, Bloody Sunday. And then you get United 93, obviously the tale of the hijacking of that passenger plane on 9/11. These are intense, very good movies. Here, though, and I'm not completely sure why, this is a case where I did just see this movie and I'm still completely trying to parse not really what all happened, because I don't think there's a whole lot to process with this film. I think it is pretty straightforward as an action movie, but just in terms of how much I really did respond to it favorably or could recommend it, because I'm in a mixed state as it is right now. But I was very aware, Josh, of the monotony of it, which I never felt with United 93 or Bloody Sunday. And again, I can't completely articulate why, but there comes a point about halfway through this film where there weren't enough new elements really being introduced or enough new shades to the characters being introduced to really keep me floating along on that lifeboat with him. I was starting to tune out a little bit, frankly, and it did take getting to about the last 10 minutes of the movie to kind of re-engage me.
I'd agree it's not a Greengrass film in that sense, where it's always rushing at you. Even his famously jostling camera and quick edits are toned down a little bit. I think they're used to good effect when the pirates actually attack the ship.
Yeah.
So that plays like a really intense sequence. But there is that middle stretch where we're left wondering what's going to happen here. Now, if you really went for this film, I could see how you could defend that as saying what we're emphasizing in those moments is the unknown and the inanity. I did get a sense of time, I'll say that, in that this felt more real to me because I had this idea this was taking place over, I don't know how many hours, but more than a day. A few times they would note, well, we're so many hours away from the coast.
Right.
And I think what that did for me, at least, is to emphasize the claustrophobia of this lifeboat they're in, the heat they reference, the lack of water. And so I don't know that I could quite say it's a weakness of the film that it does have that flagging pace in the middle, because I see what you're saying, but I do think that it's intentional. And I'll also say this to Greengrass's credit, is that I don't have a problem with his style. I know a lot of people do with
the
jumpy
camera.
I think it works, and he knows how to do it quite well. But to his credit, he backs off of that in that final scene we've talked about. And I think it must have been difficult for him. I mean, I don't know, but it's just so against the way he usually films things very well that it had to have taken a certain amount of restraint and the right kind of restraint to let that camera just sit on Hanks.
And you're absolutely right. Claustrophobia is the right word here, especially as they get into a confined space and you've got that handheld camera and it's always so close to the people. So you don't get a whole lot of wide shots usually in a Paul Greengrass movie. So you really do feel that sense of containment. And there's no doubt that's exactly what he was going for. There's no doubt that that should overall add to the experience of feeling like you understand the character's predicament. And I guess I'm just going to say the reality for me, Josh, watching it is that it just made me uncomfortable. It just made me not enjoy what I was watching at all. I really felt not seasick at any point, because I don't get that way typically with a shaky camera, but there's a lot going on inside that lifeboat and we're trapped in there for so long that I really just kind of wanted to get away from it, as opposed to it sucking me in even more and kind of heightening the visceral experience. I just didn't have that reaction to it, unfortunately. I mostly felt kind of beat down by the film, by the score, by being in that boat, and by the quick camera movements at times, especially in the dark where it's hard to really follow what's going on. Again, I don't typically have that problem with Greengrass, and I know a lot of people do. In the Bourne movies, I think it's perfect. I love that sense when they're fighting in a Bourne film, even if it's kind of hard to follow the action, you feel like, you know, you might get hit with a fist at the next punch. I like that in those movies. Here, it just didn't quite work for me as much.
I think beat down is the right phrase, though, and that's why I'd go back to saying it's probably intentional, because what you're watching is Hanks' character, who starts the film in command, surely in command, being beat down by these circumstances until he's left helpless. We should probably spend a little bit of time talking about the other lead performance, what essentially becomes a lead performance, because it's by a novice actor, Barkhad Abdi, and he plays Musay, who's the leader of this pirate gang. And the film spends quite a bit of time establishing his motivations. We first see him in his village in Somalia, and we see this band of armed men come and kind of shoo people towards the beach, encouraging them to go out and seek ships to plunder. And he gathers this band. People are jostling to be part of his crew. So you get a sense of the desperation that's fueling all of this.
Captain.
The ship's broken.
Captain, no one get hurt if you don't play no game.
It's the ship's broken. We had to go.
Nobody gets hurt. Easy. Because hey! Look at me.
Sure.
Look at me. Sure. I'm the captain now.
The actor, it's just interesting to watch a novice actor against a supreme veteran like Hanks. I think the dynamic works. I don't know if he gives a great performance. I see some people are really going crazy for his performance. I think you can see him. You can see the effort there in certain scenes. But there's something about the fact that these two characters, and I think the film ratchets up a little bit when they come face to face, are feeling each other out. And in a sense, they must be feeling each other out as actors as well. And I think that works for the dynamic between them.
Well, I think Greengrass does a good job. I like this in movies in general, when you have a large cast like this, and especially in the case of it being an international one, and you don't recognize a lot of the faces. That just does automatically add to this sort of sense of authenticity. And really, in this film, you see Tom Hanks, I maybe recognize two other actors, maybe three other actors on board that ship. Otherwise, you're seeing these new faces, and it does just sort of help you suspend disbelief, even as this is a true story. It allows you to kind of just get into the movie world, and I do love something about casting a novice actor there, really feeling like you're getting a person who there's no baggage with him. You don't bring anything to the table. You really do just see him as someone who's in a desperate situation, and you buy it. You buy it the second he appears on screen. And of course, part of it is just his physicality. They call him skinny, and the fact that he is this wiry guy, and you know, he clearly is someone, you look at his teeth and his hair and his skin condition, they really did a good job of making him seem like someone who is in that position where he's never going to stop because he's got one objective here, and he doesn't really have a whole lot of a choice in the matter. And that's something I did respond to, Josh, because I think I feared, and I don't know if people are being critical of this film for this reason or not, I feared that based on seeing in the trailer the part in particular where we get that line about how there's got to be other things you can do, Tom Hanks tells him at one point, when they're on that lifeboat, then kidnap people and try to get the ransom money. And he says, maybe in America. And I thought, oh, okay. So Greengrass, who's a guy who...
I think they play that just right.
They play it right.
Yeah.
But I feared they'd play it more.
Right.
Because it's in the trailer. And I had heard a little bit that we get some of that backstory. And the way it starts, I thought, okay, he's really going to spend a lot of time trying to create this clear dynamic between the American first world and their problems and the third world and their problems. But I don't think he does. I don't think he does ratchet that up very much at all. I think he dialed that back, and that works. But I think, Josh, the point I want to make is that it's really just good storytelling, because as I alluded to, it's not so much, I don't think, Greengrass trying to make an overt political statement. What it does is it just increases the drama, because by being introduced to him, seeing where he comes from, seeing the circumstances he comes from, we then truly understand what kind of adversary Captain Phillips is dealing with. We're dealing with a guy who has no incentive to ever back away, and he's not going to back away. And so that increases that tension, as you really do wonder, how is this going to play out, even though we may know the backstory. You really have to wonder how it's going to play out when you know you have someone who is that dangerous, frankly.
There are a few lines, maybe three, that do make some sort of geopolitical connotation, not even a statement really. But what I liked about the film is it touches on those things in much better narrative storytelling, like you said, ways. For example, one of the pirates has no shoes. Mm-hmm. He's barefoot. And that plays a major role in the developments, but it also speaks very much to their situation. It says so much about what we need to know about where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. So I like when they do it that way instead of any sort of statements. And I also think that Abdi here in this role, you know, he's thoroughly intimidating, although he is a slight figure. He's still thoroughly intimidating. That speaks to the desperation. And this actor is really carrying a lot on his shoulders, because this film, in a larger sense, you talked about how it's about people at work, and it is. It's about captains. It's really a story about
no
a succession of captains. And so you have these two opposing men, but as the Navy comes into play, we get another captain from the U.S. Navy. Then we get the leader, at least, of the SEALs.
Right.
And Greengrass spends a lot of time indicating how these different teams work, who has the chain of command, who's wrestling for authority. And a lot of it hinges upon, can Phillips get his crew in line, or can Musa get his crew in line?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of jockeying there that I found really compelling.
That's Captain Phillips. It's out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You should try to leave it with a vague Tom Hanks New England accent.
I wonder if you were going to bring that up.
You can also find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
We're going to hold a familiar movie scene against its will next in Massacre Theater. Plus, the Film Spotting poll asks you to name Brad Pitt's best supporting performance. You love Pitt so much, Adam. How will you choose?
It's going to be tough.
Stay with us.
You just won't lie down. Even closing your eyes, you can't let it go. Surrounded inside, leave it alone. You don't get it back. Undoing the things you can't explain. has someone removed and left in their place with nothing to do.
Hi, folks. Just wanted to interrupt for a second to remind you that this week's episode is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. You hear us say it all the time, whether it's for your website, your multimedia presentation, your advertisement, or any other type of film project. They've got 2D animations, 3D motion graphics, and high-quality stock video clips that come in a variety of digital formats. And I was thinking about our show ahead, Josh, the Halloween show, where we're going to talk about The Exorcist, a sacred cow discussion. I did a search for exorcism. It was late at night. I still dared to do it. I found 18 video clips, and I was brave enough to search for exorcism. I was not brave enough to watch any of them.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
No, I didn't do that late at night. I also did a search for Sea Captain.
Okay.
Thinking of Captain Phillips in our discussion
of course.
This week. 477 results came up, and Josh, I'm going to tell you, some of them were even more scary looking than the exorcism clips.
That's hard to believe. Shutterstock does have sophisticated tools to make your search easy. You can drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and more. As you find the video assets you're looking for, just save them to the clip box. Then you can access your selections anytime and share them with other team members. Shutterstock does have flexible pricing, and you can try it today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like, and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM1013, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM1013. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
Railing again at the thought of the fire for well-earned descent.
My name is Lieutenant Aldo Rain, and I'm putting together a special team, and I need me 8 soldiers. 8 Jewish American soldiers. Now, y'all might have heard rumors about the Armada happening soon. Well, we'll be leaving a little earlier. We're going to be dropped into France dressed as civilians. And once we're in enemy territory, as a bushwhacking guerrilla army, we're going to be doing one thing and one thing only. Killing Nazis.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That, of course, was Brad Pitt as Lieutenant Aldo Rain, killing Nazis with his Inglourious Basterds from the 2009 Quentin Tarantino film. Since becoming a star, Brad Pitt has taken on a few notable supporting turns. He does that as well in Steve McQueen's upcoming 12 Years a Slave. And this week's Film Spotting poll question has us looking ahead to our review of that film in a couple of weeks. We're going to ask you about the best of Brad Pitt's supporting work. Spoiler alert, there will be no California in
no,
the poll.
No, we didn't include that?
No, because
he's kind of a co-lead.
It drives me crazy.
Oh, that's the problem.
Every moment of Brad Pitt in that film drives me crazy. Speaking of bad performances, let's get now to Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam, Michael Phillips, and I massacred this scene.
You know what? Villages like this, they make up a song about every big thing that happens. Sing them for years.
You think it's worth it?
Don't you?
It's only a matter of knowing how to shoot a gun. Nothing big about that.
How can you talk like this? Your gun has got you everything you have. Isn't that true? But isn't it true?
Yeah, sure, everything. After a while, you can call bartenders and faro dealers by their first name. Maybe 200 of them. Rented rooms you live in, 500. Meals you eat in hash houses, 1,000. Home, none. Wife, none. Kids, none. Prospects, zero. Suppose I left anything out.
That was the other Steve McQueen as Vin Tanner, Yul Brynner as Chris Adams, and Horst Buchholz as Chico in The Magnificent Seven from 1960. It was written by William Roberts and directed by John Sturges.
Joe from Nashua, New Hampshire wrote in, the tie-in is obviously in keeping with the top five from your last show, movie themes, and the score is one of the most iconic in all the film. But let me dig a little deeper. The Magnificent Seven also features Eli Wallach, the actor best known for his role as Tuco in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the correct answer for best movie theme of all time, but I'll let it pass just this once. I thought you all had interesting picks all around, and there were several, particularly in Michael Phillips' choices, that I will now have to seek out and decide for myself. Thanks for the entertainment, guys. This is a really great show. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, thanks for the pass. Mark Taylor from West Monroe, Louisiana, said, I'm sure you'll get thousands of responses to this Massacre Theater, since it's such an archetypal Western with an unforgettable score and an iconic cast. And no, Adam, yours was not the most iconic role, although Steve is the more beloved and bigger star. In this movie, Yul Brynner is definitely the icon. On the strength of this one role, he was the obvious choice to embody the prototypical Western gunman in 1973's Westworld. While the picture does not quite do justice to the Seven Samurai, it is, with Shane and High Noon, the very definition of the American Western. By the way, I thought Michael did a terrific job as the implacable recruiter and leader of the Seven.
What's with Michael Phillips getting all the praise here?
Hey, he gave it his all on that
he
one.
He did.
We haven't
did.
Seen that spirited of a Massacre Theater performance from him in a while.
That's a very good point. Josh, we did not get a lot of entries.
What?
Again. The Magnificent Seven. I don't know. Maybe my McQueen just wasn't up to snuff, but
that's surprising.
It's slim pickings there in the film spotting hat. Reach in and pick out this week's winner.
Winner is Jefferson Hyde from Seattle, Washington.
I love it. Jefferson, the guy who every week tries to battle for comment supremacy and nail all the tie-ins and come up with a few other crazy ones.
He's
from
earned
Massacre
this.
Theater. He's definitely earned it. Congratulations, Jefferson. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Scene, man, memorize it.
What?
Look, man, an undercover cop's gotta be Marlon Brando, right? To do this job, you gotta be a great actor. You gotta be naturalistic. You gotta be naturalistic as hell.
All right, let's see if we can reach the new high standard set by Michael Phillips with this week's edition of Massacre Theater. It is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
And I was looking, Josh, at what's new this week on Fandor. In honor of Eleanor Roosevelt's birthday on October 11th, they did just post The Eleanor Roosevelt Story, which is a documentary from 1965, won a lot of praise that year, including winning the Academy Award for Best Documentary. And I picked it, Josh, frankly, because I just don't know much at all about Eleanor Roosevelt, except that she was one of our most influential first ladies. So that documentary pick appealed to me.
I can't tell you much either, except that Olivia Williams is very good as her in the recent Hyde Park on Hudson with Bill Murray.
Even though that movie sort of...
The movie is not very good.
Okay.
She's
but
about
she's
the only good thing in it.
Yeah. Well, you are probably a fan going back even to Rushmore,
that's
I'm guessing,
right,
of Olivia Williams. Well, let's get to Massacre Theater for this week. We're not giving you any hints whatsoever. If we're doing our jobs, if we can act these scenes properly at all, it really should be obvious and we should get flooded with entries, but I don't know that we can pull that off.
I don't know what's been going on lately, so we'll see.
Okay. You started off. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
Yeah.
And action.
You think I wouldn't have been prepared? 2 years I spent setting up that elevator job. 2 years I invested myself in it. You couldn't understand the kind of commitment that I have. You ruined a man's life's work and you think you can walk away? You got blinders on to the world. But I got your attention now, didn't I, Ted?
Why didn't you just come after me?
No, this is about me. This is about my money. This is about money due me, which I will collect. $3.7 million. It's my nest egg, Ted. At my age, you got to think ahead.
When I find you... And scene.
I think I was doing somebody completely different than who that actually is.
You were actually channeling Chucky again from Child's
Play,
Josh.
No, it's not Chucky.
You were going to your Chucky voice one more time. And yes, we did change the name in that scene. There is no Ted in that scene. Or is there? That's all we're going to give you by way of a hint. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, October 28th, so you do have a little bit of extra time to get in your entry.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Yeah! Yes! Look what I have created! I have made fire!
Well, we had a lot of praise for Tom Hanks and his performance in Captain Phillips. Earlier in the show, we now hear him there in a scene from Castaway starring as Chuck Nolan. I did always love that line when he's so proud of himself for making fire. And anticipating our discussion of Captain Phillips, we wanted to ask you, what your favorite Tom Hanks performance was. And I think we did pretty good with this poll question, especially, Josh, if you look at how close the entries
were.
Yeah,
it's tight.
Until you get into the comments and you see how much we angered people.
And we're going to have to say Sam was right about those two.
Yeah, he did. Sam, our producer, did get this right, and we kind of trumped him, and we get to be the bad guys here. We gave you these options for best Tom Hanks performance: Andrew Beckett in Philadelphia, Forrest Gump in Forrest Gump, Captain Miller from Saving Private Ryan, Chuck Nolan from Castaway, or Woody, just going with a vocal performance from Toy Story. We did not give you an other or some other of his performances. Josh, how did it come out?
Well, this was really tight all along, but in last place here is Hank's previous captain, Captain Miller. Andrew Beckett from Philadelphia came in second to last with 18%. Woody from Toy Story, 20% of the vote in the middle there. And then Forrest Gump himself, second place, 21% of the vote. So the win went to Chuck Noland, 25%.
So I don't think we shared our picks on our last show with Michael Phillips. Josh, where would you have gone in the poll?
I would go that way too. I mean, I think his performance as Gump is really strong. I know it's made fun of a lot now, but the way he plays that is the reason that movie works for me. But really, the degree of difficulty in Castaway and how good he is there carrying the entire film, I think you got to go there.
I probably would have gone Forrest Gump.
Really?
I really would have. So sorry, Forrest Gump haters. I agree with you completely. I think his performance does ultimately make that movie work. And
would
you
have
talk
been a
about,
brutal movie with a lot of other actors.
You're right. And you want to talk about end kind of dramatic scenes that pay off. There's a sequence with him late in that film that I just don't know how many other actors would really hit with that kind of truthfulness that he does there. So I probably would have gone there. But I did hint on our last show that if I was choosing and we had other as an option, which we really should have had, I might have gone actually with his performance in a movie I don't like all that much, but I do obviously love his performance. It's The Green Mile.
Mm.
Not a big fan of that film, but I love his role there. I
Better
love
than
his
these?
Performance. I'm just saying, I remember sitting in the theater watching that film, and I haven't seen it since, but I remember watching it in the theater and just feeling like I was watching an actor in complete control of every single moment, like playing the audience like a fiddle. If he wanted the audience to be angry with him or feel happiness or relieved or feel aroused, whatever it was in the scene, Tom Hanks got that out of every member of the audience. I could actually see people around me reacting the way he seemed to be wanting them to react. So I just remember that experience. I might have gone Green Mile.
I don't remember being aroused by much in Green Mile. Wasn't
there's
it like 4.5 hours
there's
long?
There's a good scene with his wife there where, you know, okay, he finally can let some feelings out.
All right.
Let's just put it that way, Josh. Apparently, I remember that movie a lot better than you do. Well, let's get to those comments. And we can't have poll comments without starting with Max O'Connell in Syracuse, New York. He says, I'm torn between two Hanks performances, but only one is a poll option. The first is as Captain Miller in Saving Private Ryan, a role that balances Hanks' innate likability with streaks of pragmatism and weariness, as if his goodness and warmth was almost worn down by the harsh realities of war. I don't think it's almost worn down. I think it is worn down, and I think Max says that very well. The second is as Josh Baskin in Big, the film that best takes advantage of Hanks' natural playfulness and savvy as a comedic actor.
And that's an option Sam originally had.
He did.
We thought, that's got to go out.
We overruled it.
This is going to be a familiar theme here. Susan Walker says, surprised that Big didn't make the list or a mention on the podcast. That would have been my pick.
DB Sweeney says, I have to agree with the others. Where's Big? And finally, we'll share Emily's note. She says, no joking, it's Josh Baskin in Big.
I don't understand why it's not even an option in the poll. If you were to ask when most of us first noticed him, the answer would overwhelmingly be his performance in Big. If it's on TV, you're going to watch it until the very end. Castaway, chances are slim. The Terminal, never. And I love him in Joe versus the Volcano, Turner and Hooch, and The Money Pit. 90s Tom Hanks may have won Oscars. 80s Tom Hanks won my heart.
Well, I agree with you there, Emily, but I'm never going to forgive her for pointing out if you were to ask when most of us first noticed him and she picks what movie? Big, as opposed to, I don't know, the movie that most of us, including the two old men here in the room, noticed him, which was Splash, like 1981.
But is that, there's that much time between Big and Splash? Because they're like around the same time frame.
Are they?
In my mind.
I mean, Big's
got
to
sure.
be the mid-80s, isn't it? Or even the mid to late 80s. And yes, we should be able to Google this as we talk. And maybe, Josh, you can do that while I banter here a little bit.
1988.
There you go.
You were right. So yeah, that is...
Yeah. Big gap, 7 years there. It was
I probably saw him
Splash
on TV is where I would have first seen both of those films and within, you know, the same time frame of each other, which is probably why they're the same in my mind.
Yeah, I do love, though, early Tom Hanks stuff, including Bachelor Party, which, you know what, at some point we're going to break down and do a comedy for a Sacred Cow discussion, and I'm nominating Bachelor Party.
Oh, man.
He's so good in that film. I also love him in Punchline. Not a great film, but he's good in it. He's really good in just about anything. Tom Hanks, for me, Josh, has never been bad, except actually in The Road to Perdition.
Can we do Joe versus the Volcano instead of Bachelor Party?
No. No. It's nowhere near the masterpiece Bachelor Party is. But real quick, to close this up, going back to the whole Big thing, and I'm going to get in trouble for this, especially as I praise Forrest Gump. My whole thing with Big is it's kind of a stunt performance. He gets to act like a 12-year-old kid. I'd rather have him be a dramatic actor.
Have you ever been to a comedy improv show and seen how terrible it is when adults try to act like kids? I mean, just to make that bearable is an achievement, and he makes it really affecting. I do think that's a great performance.
You know what? I have an issue with Big, though, and it's really the fact that he acts like a kid who's really about 7 in that movie, not 12 or 13.
I think we got to do the sacred cow of Big at this point.
Maybe we should. I just don't see it that way. Apparently, a lot of Film Spotting listeners do see it as a sacred cow. I will accept your hate mail humbly. Let's move on to this week's poll question. We go to another heavyweight Hollywood actor, Brad Pitt. Though we're not going to look at lead performances, we're going to focus on his supporting turns, because really that's probably when Pitt's been at his best over his career. I think many people might agree with that statement. So as we talk about 12 Years a Slave in a couple weeks here on the show, really anticipating that new film directed by Steve McQueen. I don't know why we're not focusing on Chiwetel Ejiofor or Michael Fassbender, my boy, instead.
He gets enough attention.
He does. So I guess we're going to go to Pitt, because Brad Pitt doesn't get enough attention. And we're going to ask you, which of these Brad Pitt performances in a supporting role is your favorite? The options are
Dick Ritchie's stoner roommate Floyd from True Romance, Jeffrey Goines from 12 Monkeys, Chad Feldheimer in Burn After Reading, Lieutenant Aldo Rain, who we heard from previously in Inglourious Bastards, and Mr. O'Brien from The Tree of Life.
Well, for me, Josh, I find two of those supporting turns super annoying, so I'll save that for our next show when we read the results. There's a no-brainer here, though. We're both going with Tree of Life, right, Mr. O'Brien?
It stands out so much because it's the one dramatic role, and I actually think Pitt's at his best as a comedian. He's okay. Good in Tree of Life, but he's not that essential to that film. For me, what I remember most about Burn After Reading, and what I enjoyed the most, is Pitt.
He's pretty good there, and I probably didn't fully appreciate that Coen Brothers effort. We want to know what you think, though. Tell us your favorite Brad Pitt supporting role. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, that's where you can get our bonus content every week. If you have the Film Spotting iPhone app or Android app or the Windows 8 phone app, you can also just go to filmspotting.net and click on apps to get all the information you need. And we're not going to have any bonus content for this particular show, Josh, but I did want to highlight the fact that last week, as we promised, Michael Phillips waxed on poetically, very eloquently, about some more of his favorite themes. And we were a little late posting that bonus content. I know a lot of people were seeking it out. So I just say, if you enjoyed that show at all, and if you enjoy hearing Michael Phillips talk about music and movies, and why wouldn't you? We certainly did enjoy having him on the show. That bonus content is available for that episode. It's episode 463. Another quick plug, Josh. I heard recently via email from the director, Zach Levy, who made a movie called Strong Man. I think it played here at the Chicago Film Festival, maybe, but it's not a movie that got a wide distribution. It's a really interesting documentary, though, where he follows a guy named Stan Steel, who can bend steel, and he claims to be, you know, the world's strongest man and that kind of thing. And you see a guy really who's now at middle age or approaching middle age and isn't quite the young buck he once was, and maybe is seeing his life and his intended fame slipping away from him. And it's kind of a tragic tale. And I had a chance to interview that director, Zach Levy, here on the show. I think it was a couple years ago in 2011. And that movie, Strong Man, if you're curious, is just now getting a proper DVD and digital release. It just came out here on October 15th. So if you remember that interview but didn't get a chance to seek out the film, you can now find it via digital and DVD. And finally, Josh, we're both periodically writing on Letterboxd. We've both promoted that site quite a bit. We're big fans of that site. And I know you've been adding some reviews there of movies that we don't get a chance to talk about on the show. I've been doing the same. I actually tried to get into a little bit of a long-form discussion bouncing off of what we talked about last week on the show in terms of Gravity and particularly the gender debate. So I use Letterboxd to get into that a little bit. So if you're not following us on Letterboxd, you probably should. You recommend it.
You were pushing the Letterboxd word limit with that post, actually.
Yeah.
I was waiting to see how long that would go on.
Yeah.
What was that at? Was that at 2,000?
I actually
did. 2000?
No, I did not hit 2,000. I did throw it into Word to check word count when it was done, just because I was like, really, how much did I write? And it was 1,250. And I haven't written 1,250 words on a film. I mean, obviously, I've talked a lot here on the show over 8 years, but I probably haven't written 1,200 words about a movie since I was in grad school.
But it is cool that the site, it allows for that, and it allows for like one word things, one sentence things, or even just quick ratings. So yeah, it's a fun site.
There you go. So you can find Josh, he's Larson on Film over at Letterboxd. Just do a search for Josh Larson or do a search for Adam Kempinar. You can find me at letterboxd.com/filmspotting.
Sam, look, we got him. We don't even know it. We've got the hostages. You know, we've been looking at this the wrong way. We make the demands. They're going to give us anything we want. I'm flying to the tropics. F*** the snow. Hey, where's the mail? You ready to go to Algeria?
Algeria? Yeah, sure.
We're all going to sunny climes. Sal, I can make it happen. I can make it happen. I made it happen so far, right? I can make it happen.
Al Pacino again there as Sonny in Sidney Lumet's 1975 film Dog Day Afternoon. And as we get into the film spotting top five this week, tying in with our discussion of Captain Phillips, we're sharing our top five hostage movies. Dog Day Afternoon, one of the first films that popped into our minds, as it should, because it's a classic, and it's such a classic, Josh, that it's in the film spotting pantheon. So it's off limits. We cannot include it in our top five, and that means we had to venture out of that comfort zone and find some other picks. I don't know if you want to set up a little bit what we're defining a hostage movie as. There's really maybe just a little bit of a distinction that needs to be made between a hostage movie and a kidnapping movie, and I don't know if that then made you relegate some other films that seem kind of like they could be hostage movies and would be movies that you could potentially include in a top five that you had to leave out. Did that happen?
Once I started to make a list of those that first came to mind, it became pretty clear that some were indeed kidnapping movies, which I feel, let's say Raising Arizona. So the victim was taken to be kept. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas a hostage movie, there's a means to an end there. There's some sort of goal that's trying to be achieved by holding the person.
Yeah, there's some either money hoping to be gained,
right,
or there's a case where they're using the people as leverage to get something else out of it. For me, there were three movies that I really strongly considered that I came up with excuses to leave off, or in the case of at least two of them, I probably wasn't really stretching. They just really don't belong as hostage movies. One of them is United 93, the Paul Greengrass movie, where it's 9/11. They clearly take these people hostage on board that flight, but they're not trying to do any bargaining. There's nothing going on there in terms of leverage.
I would have allowed that, actually.
Would you?
Yeah.
See, that doesn't make sense to me as a hostage movie. At least I tried to focus on the case where there's that bargaining power dynamic that's going on in so many hostage movies. And there's no power shift or dynamic there because it really is just about using those people.
True.
They're just on board the plane. Another movie I left off, I know this would not have made your top five anyway, but the Michael Haneke film, Funny Games.
Yeah, I saw that suggested a lot.
Left it off because even though I actually quite like that movie, again, they're not hoping to get anything in exchange for these people. They take them hostage, I guess. They take that family hostage in their own home, but nothing being bargained for. They're not after money. They're just playing sadistic, funny games with them, so it doesn't really work. And lastly, this is the one I know people probably take an issue with, but the Coen Brothers movie Fargo. I think that's a case where you could definitely say it's a hostage situation. They clearly are trying to use her to get money, but I just didn't feel like, compared to some of my other picks, again, that bargaining process, the negotiation, that power dynamic, that's not really what Fargo's about to me. So I excluded it, even though I love the movie.
Yeah, I didn't focus quite so much on the bargaining dynamic, though I think that does make a lot of sense. What struck me about this is how many hostage movies there are, and I think that's because it's really an easy, cheap trick in a lot of ways. It's easy suspense, quick drama. You set up that situation, and all of a sudden you have tension, right? So what I wanted to do with my list is go with films that did something unexpected with this familiar movie setup.
Okay.
Do something a little different. Use it for something more than convenient tension. So these picks hopefully do that. And I'm going to start out with A Life Less Ordinary, which is not one of Danny Boyle's most acclaimed efforts. I think probably the fact that I appreciated Trance more than most people shows that I'm maybe more forgiving of him than most. This has Ewan McGregor as a disgruntled janitor who's replaced by a robot, and then as his revenge, he kidnaps the boss's daughter, played by Cameron Diaz. And it's really a good, goofy match, I feel, between these two in this film, which essentially wants to be a romantic comedy. It even has this charming dance number to Bobby Darin's Beyond the Sea.
And if I could fly like birds on high, then straight to your arms, I'd go sailing.
It's far,
beyond the star. It's near beyond the moon.
What happens is that these two eventually fall for each other, and then they decide to blackmail her dad anyway to finance their fresh start. So it's sort of kidnapping, but then that fake hostage situation comes into play. And I like how it uses the hostage conceit essentially as one long meet-cute scenario. I just like that twist. This film, it's really pretty much a lark, but has a talented supporting cast. You've got Ian Holm, Stanley Tucci, Holly Hunter, and Delroy Lindo all having a ton of fun. Boyle is very much a genre dabbler, and in some ways, you mentioned Fargo, I can see this as being his attempt at a Coen Brothers film, and I think he does a fairly good job of it.
So A Life Less Ordinary, you said maybe not one of Danny Boyle's more acclaimed films, so unacclaimed, I never bothered to see it, actually.
Is it the only one you've never seen?
I think it's the only Danny Boyle film I haven't seen.
You probably wouldn't like it.
No, I probably wouldn't.
Don't even bother.
I love that you just know me so well.
I'm giving up on
you
in certain situations.
Well, I will take that. My number five hostage movie is a film that I don't think has really been mentioned much at all over the years on this show, but it did just come up recently in passing when we were sharing our top five most anticipated Chicago Film Fest movies, and I highlighted the new movie How I Live Now, directed by Kevin MacDonald. I mentioned one of his early documentaries is One Day in September, which is my number five pick. It's a 1999 documentary that shows all the details about the 1972 murder of 11 Israeli athletes that happened at the Summer Olympics in Munich, and it is a riveting tale. If you're like me and you weren't alive in 1972 to actually watch this unfold, you maybe only heard vague details about it. You knew the general story. I knew there was a hostage situation at those Olympics, didn't really know the details or know how it played out. And so then when I saw this movie in 1999, it was incredibly suspenseful. And I think it would be even if you know exactly what happened to these athletes and the tragic ending. But from the very opening, they show you how the German security force there and the German government just really never considered that an event like this could possibly happen. They weren't at all prepared from a security standpoint. Nobody was trained to deal with a situation like it. So they had all sorts of problems right from the beginning. The terrorists were in a little bit over their heads as well. And what we do see in the end, it all culminate with this botched rescue. It's a movie I was looking at Roger Ebert's review today, and he did recommend One Day in September, but he was kind of reserved in his praise, mainly because he felt like MacDonald didn't do enough to really ever try to articulate the Palestinian side of it, why they did have this mission and why they took these people hostage. My guess is that Kevin MacDonald might say that, well, there's only one of the participants still alive, and I got him to be on camera. What more can I really do? Either way, I haven't seen the movie since it came out in 1999 or 2000 on DVD, and I'm really curious to go back and watch it again and see if that's something that would stick out to me. But visceral, that term we use a lot here on the show, really applies to One Day in September. And I think part of what makes you so uncomfortable watching is just seeing how so much of it possibly could have been avoided. The movie really highlights how many things went wrong. So that's my number five hostage movie.
Well, going back to Ebert's concern, access is such a huge thing for a documentarian, right? And it certainly sounds like he at least put in that effort there. My number four is Paranormal Activity 3, which is perhaps the weakest. You haven't seen any of these, right?
No, I haven't. I'm too scared.
You would be. You would be terrified. And I'll admit, this is probably the weakest of the first three films. Now, I haven't seen four yet, so I can't speak to that.
There are four of them, really?
I think there might. I've kind of gotten out. I mean, as much as I like them, I've had enough of them in my life. There might even be five. I've lost track. But this one, at least up till three, it was still a really good piece of found footage horror. And it's the one that involves hostage taking the most. All of them have that to a degree. But this one really centers on that. It's a prequel. And so it follows the series central figure who's played by Katie Featherston when she was a little girl. And it tries to establish the root mythology of the series, which involves this coven, I never remember which one it is, of witches. And that's where the hostage element does come into play. So hostage taking here, it's sort of part of a curse. That's what they do with it. Now, the best parts of this film, though, are still these ingenious boo moments, which is why it would scare you, Adam. And they involve all these things that are captured with home video cameras that have been set up to reveal what's been haunting this house. If you think that a bedsheet as a ghost is this tired Halloween trope, then you need to see Paranormal Activity 3.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, for my number four, I'm going with yet another much more conventional pick, Josh, as you're taking the more idiosyncratic route this week. The Spike Lee movie, Inside Man, I believe from 2006, starring Denzel Washington, also Clive Owen. I was looking back at my notes from that review, which was reviewed very favorably here on Film Spotting. almost every scene in that movie, even the ones that don't directly have to do with the negotiation. And this is a film where Clive Owen and some of his fellow members of this bank heist gang, they take over a bank. They take everyone hostage inside. They're dealing with Denzel Washington on the outside as the cop who is trying to be the lead negotiator. And you're always questioning really what the motive is here. What are Clive Owen and his people ultimately after? And as I said, power is the real dynamic here, because in every scene, that's the exchange going on, even down to the scenes, Josh, where Denzel Washington is talking to his girlfriend, who he lives with. It's always about power, who has the upper hand. Unfortunately, this is also the performance from Jodie Foster, like her recent turn in Elysium, where I find her just unwatchable, but she's not so unwatchable that it ruins the movie for me.
You think she's Elysium bad?
Yeah, I do think she's Elysium bad.
Wow.
I do, in Inside Man, unfortunately. But the other thing I really love about Inside Man is how meticulous it is and how Spike Lee seems to get that we've all seen a million bank heist movies. And so they just sort of acknowledge that right from the beginning, and you get it in the voiceover, and it really just trusts our intelligence. It knows that we've seen all these movies too, so it doesn't really waste our time. The key thing for me too, Josh, and why I wanted to pick it for this list as we focus on hostage movies, is that the guy who's taking people hostage, I think, is ultimately the hero of this movie. And I think we like Clive Owen's character actually better than we probably like Denzel Washington's character, even though he's still a pretty good guy and it's really hard not to like Denzel Washington. But I was ultimately always more interested in what strings the Clive Owen character is pulling. And I do think he's very good in that role. So that's my number four hostage movie, Inside Man.
Pop quiz, hotshot. What's my number one hostage movie of all time? I'll give you the answer in part two of the Film Spotting Top 5 up next. Stay with us.
Spirit out, this isn't where you are. Lit up by the dying of the stars. Rising as they're finally breaking through. All the shutters find, standing back beyond and left behind. Someone who's been calling out for you. He's brought on back to life unknown. How do you get to where you go? Moving as you want to. Some do, waking just in time to miss the show. Longing where you know you don't belong.
Another interruption here, but there's no better interruption than just to say thanks, which is what we're going to do now, as we thank our listeners for donating some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of Film Spotting. Josh, we have three new $5 a month donors to thank.
That would be Stefan from Nonthaburi, Thailand.
We don't get a lot of donors from Thailand.
No.
That's great.
Christopher from Lexington, Kentucky. And then Juicy?
Yusi. I think you'd say Yusi.
Yusi from Helsinki, Finland.
Finland.
Thank you.
And Thailand and Kentucky. That's all you need to know about Film Spotting. Other donors we want to thank this week. Adam, he's in the wonderfully named Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. And he's got a note, Josh. I'm going to be honest. It's not very often that I read some comments from a listener during donations, and I really don't know what they're talking about, but I don't completely get where Adam's going with this. So let's just read it. Maybe other listeners will figure it out.
All right, let's see what we got. This is a one-time donation from the Taminga Charitable Mailing Society in memory of the We Need to Talk About Kevin film adaptation, born 19 April 2010 and cruelly slain by Film Spotting on 2 February 2012.
So we did somewhat infamously review that movie, not favorably here on the show. I think like your third episode.
Yeah.
We do have a great listener and donor, member of our FAB, the Film Spotting Advisory Board, named Melissa Taminga.
I noticed that.
And I want to say she's a really big fan of that book. So Adam must be referencing that in some way. I don't know, but hey.
That
we'll
review hasn't come back to haunt us in
it
quite
really
a while.
No.
So I'm glad it's been revived.
Adam must be going through the archives there. We also got this one. And as if the Melissa connections here weren't already sort of weird, Scarlett Tang writes in, she's from Bellingham, Washington. That's where Melissa lives.
Something's going on.
Something is funky.
Scarlett says, when I heard the Magnificent Seven soundtrack on the latest episode, I knew it was time to pay my dealers. In college, I had to write a paper on the Magnificent Seven and how it reflected the United States self-image at the beginning of the 1960s. And it was the first time I had ever analyzed a film beyond whether I liked it or not. Thanks to my professor, Sean Rosenheim, for introducing me to film studies, and to Film Spotting for continuing my education. I also wanted to give a shout-out to Ravelry, the knitting social media site where I first heard about Film Spotting. Knitters spend a lot of time listening to audiobooks and podcasts, and word gets around about great shows like yours. Thanks so much.
We've heard that laughter before. In your voice, but yes, we have many listeners who are knitters.
Uh-huh.
It comes up quite a bit, so hey, I'll take it. Knitters World.
Knitters and Runners, right?
We need Runners World sponsorship and Knitters World. I'm sure that magazine exists. We'll stay in the Pacific Northwest. Alicia in Corvallis, Oregon says, this donation was made on behalf of my partner, Tucker Selko, in honor of his birthday. Tucker's birthday was October 13th, so we are happy to give a shout out to Tucker, who Alicia says is a big fan of the show. He also lives in Corvallis. Again, happy birthday, Tucker.
Thanks for not making me say Oregon, too. I appreciate
that.
That's
true. How did I miss that opportunity to let you say that?
Anyways, Arlene from Ashburn, Virginia said, I first learned of your podcast through my childhood friend, Kendra. Her birthday is coming up, so instead of getting her a gift, I'm sending you a donation.
That makes perfect sense.
I mean,
you know, don't give Kendra a gift, give us a gift.
That works for me.
Sure.
We started our love of films early in life. As young teens, we would go to the video store and rent two VHS tapes and also come home with an entire tape full of previews. We'd make notes on which movies to rent next. I think we were the only ones in the store who ever checked out those preview tapes. I never even heard of those. That was 30 years ago, Arlene says. We are still good friends and we still love movies. Although we live in separate cities now, we make a point to attend the Virginia Film Festival in her hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia, each November. We proudly wear our Film Spotting shirts to the festival. Thanks for the hours of entertainment.
I say pictures or it didn't happen. We got to see pictures of them at the festival. Next one around with their Film Spotting shirts.
They're already giving donations in lieu of birthday gifts. How much do you want?
Okay, fine. Well, happy birthday, Kendra, and thank you so much for that note, Arlene. Again, if you are a Film Spotting listener who likes the show, wants to support the show, but just isn't ready to fork over any cash, that's fine. We get it. You can go over to iTunes and rate us if you haven't already. It takes just a second. We are making our push to get to 1,000 ratings, and we are very close, if not right at 1,000. I haven't looked for about a week, Josh. So we'd love any reviews you're able to give us or just that star rating, whatever you want to do over in iTunes. It does help us out. It does help us reach new listeners. A note about our music this week, we are featuring Richard Buckner, and he's an artist that we featured several times on the show over the years, but not since 2008. You heard tracks from his new album Surrounded, including the title track and also Lean To. He's currently wrapping up a U.S. tour and then heading over to Europe in early December with stops in Belgium, Germany, Denmark, and Sweden. We have listeners in all of those countries, Josh, and if you want more information, you can find it at richardbuckner.com.
Steady but just out of time, taken by a stolen line. You shouldn't, but you cry now.
This is Josh Brolin from The Goonies 2. You're listening to Film Spotting.
The cops ain't likely to catch up with us, not tonight. So we can all be quiet and peaceable and have a few beers together and listen to the music. And not make any wrong moves. Because I may as well tell you folks that old Ruby there with the gun, he's pretty nervous and jumpy. He's got the itch between his fingers. So let's everybody stay where they are.
Let there be killing. All this evening I've had a feeling of destiny closing in. Do you believe in astrology?
I couldn't say, pal.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam. We're in the midst of our top five hostage movies, and that was Leslie Howard and Humphrey Bogart in 1936's The Petrified Forest. I think this is maybe a little bit more conventional of a pick for you here, Adam. It's a noir precursor and really features Bogart's breakout role as Duke Mantee. And for this list, what's interesting is that it's already a hostage movie before any hostages are taken. It's set in an isolated roadway diner in the Arizona desert where the owner's daughter, who's played by Betty Davis, wants to get away from, in her words, these sun-baked, ignorant desert rats and move to France. She envisions herself as this budding intellectual. Well, along comes this drifter, a Brit played by Leslie Howard, and he seems to offer her that chance. They kind of connect on that level. But then Bogart's Duke Mantee interrupts, and he's this gangster who's hiding out, takes everyone in the diner hostage while the law converges on him. So what I like about this film, and it really does elevate when Bogart comes on screen, you can see why this cemented him in the minds of American moviegoers. What I really like about the film is that it has this double tension going here. First, we're worried, will Davis's Gabrielle survive the night? And second, we want to know, will she escape this suffocating life that's been holding her back, holding her hostage in a sense?
Well, my number three hostage movie, I'm going with the 2010 Olivier Assayas film, Carlos. And it's actually three different movies or parts of a miniseries, though there are different versions of the film. You can watch all 5.5 hours of it, which did play at Cannes that year. But there are also abridged versions of like 187 minutes, 166 minutes. I have watched all three parts and never really seen the abridged ones. But I'm specifically picking for my number three, Josh, segment two, because that part two is the one that's devoted almost entirely to the 1975 terrorist attack that Carlos the Jackal, the lead character, led on OPEC headquarters. He and a group of, I think, six others take all the delegates and the ministers inside from OPEC hostage and does try to get away on a DC-9. And this portion is 106 minutes long. So it really is kind of its own feature film. Like I said, mostly given over to that hostage situation. And you want to talk about intense experiences. That's what you get, particularly in this segment of Carlos. What ends up happening, without spoiling anything, I'll just say that it's a situation where Carlos can't get asylum in some countries he's hoping to get to, and then the DC-9 they requested can't get to Iraq, which is a country they could potentially seek asylum in. And so he's kind of stuck, and he's forced into making a crucial decision in the life of a terrorist here, in the case of a revolutionary, which he fancies himself as, which is, what are you ultimately taking hostages for, and how far are you willing to go to get what you want? Are you a man of principle? Do your actions match your words? Or are you all talk? Are you really just in this for the notoriety, for the fame, for the money, for the ancillary things that maybe come with kind of being this rock star revolutionary? And we really do see that in this segment, too, in particular. He's kind of at the height of his fame. But this episode really does tell us the answer to that question. It tells us what kind of man Carlos is. So that's my number three.
Haven't seen any incarnation of that film, actually, but sounds like a perfect fit. My number two is Tangled, and if I was going to go the animation route, probably Disney's Beauty and the Beast is a better fit. It's certainly a better film, but I did have that in my top five traditionally animated movies when we did that list. So Tangled is a good substitute. It's a 2010 musical that's firmly rooted in the Disney tradition of princesses and the evil women who would harm them. And this being the story of Rapunzel, of course, it involves hostage-taking. The relationship here between Mother Gothel and Rapunzel, Mother Gothel is the woman who kidnaps her for the restorative power of her hair, that relationship is really the best part of the film. It's not just that it's physical hostage-taking, it's emotional hostage-taking as well. So the movie turns very much on this passive-aggressive mother and rebellious teen dynamic, especially in some of the musical numbers. I love the one Mother Knows Best.
You know why we stay up in this tower?
I know.
That's right, to keep you safe and sound, dear. Guess I always knew this day was coming. Knew that soon you'd want to leave the nest. Soon, but not yet. But shh, trust me, pet. Mother knows best.
Mandy Moore plays Rapunzel, but the movie is absolutely made by Tony Award-winning actress Donna Murphy as Mother Gothel. I'd even put her up there with Maleficent and Ursula as one of the great Disney villainesses. And she's sort of like this vain housewife of Fairy Tale Hill. She's hooked on this magical form of plastic surgery. As a matter of fact, I don't think that it's coincidence that when she's fully rejuvenated, the animated character looks an awful lot like Cher.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, my number two hostage movie is the sixth film, the final movie in Film Spotting's Kurosawa Marathon that we did have back in 2009. We talked about High and Low, and we discussed it on episode 278 of the show. So I'll be brief here because you can go back and listen to that review if you're so inclined. But this is a movie about a wealthy executive played by the great collaborator of Kurosawa, Toshiro Mifune. He plays a man named Gondo who is engaged in this power struggle within a company he runs, and he's doing this leverage buyout, and he's about to take control of things. And then something happens where he gets a phone call from someone claiming to have just taken his son and is holding his son hostage. What ends up coming to light is that the hostage taker doesn't really have his son, Gondo's son. He has the chauffeur's son. So now imagine, you want to talk about your great high concepts. Imagine being in that situation where it's one thing to think about, what am I willing to do to get my child back? But what am I willing to do to get someone who works for me, their child back? What's the right thing to do there, really? And you can see all the different factors that play into the decision he ultimately makes. During that discussion, we did compare the movie to Rashomon quite a bit, the first film in that Kurosawa marathon. And that's a movie, Josh, that I love because we see all these different views of one single crime, and you never really can pinpoint exactly what the truth is. And then you got a movie like High and Low, which almost seems like the opposite. It's a case where you know exactly what's happening. You know all the facts of the case, and there's a lot made of evidence and processing that evidence. But what you can't get at, what High and Low really shows us, is you can't really get at the bigger truths, the larger questions about why. Why something like this happens and how you solve some of the underlying problems that lead to a situation like this. And in particular, that gap, that disparity between the high, the people who live up on the hill, the 1%, if you will, and the people like the kidnapper, the 99% who live down below. Mifune, always a great actor, but can be kind of big, to go back to your Captain Phillips mention of Tom Hanks there in your setup question, Josh. He sometimes can be a larger than life performer, really restrained, really brings a lot of kind of smoldering intensity and stoicism to this character. And ultimately, you get to see kind of the anguish on his face and the toll this whole process is taking. I love this performance a lot. That's High and Low.
I'm so glad you included it, because I meant to catch up with it and see it for the first time, just couldn't fit it in.
So good.
I am going to stick with a foreign film, though, for my follow-up and my number one, and it's Dogtooth, a 2009 film from Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos. And hostage-taking here, it's a form of control, specifically parental control.
You're saying they're taking their own children hostage?
Exactly.
Wow.
Which is just one level of the creepiness of this incessantly creepy movie. So yeah, a mother and father here, they've raised their now adult children in utter seclusion, never allowing them to leave this walled compound, telling them the world beyond is full of danger. So it's hostage taking by psychological force, in a sense. And just the perversity of this imprisonment. I mean, the way they switch the meanings of words so that telephone they've trained them means salt. The promise that they can leave when they lose a dog tooth. And it only gets worse from there if you've seen the film. So the insidious brilliance of this movie, though, is the way Lanthimos, he makes the viewer a hostage as well. That's how I feel watching it. The way he carefully arranges each frame. He often leaves crucial action just beyond the edge of the screen. Mm-hmm. And he only allows us to see what he wants us to, not what we need or think we need. And of course, there's the added effect. We never really get an explanation, a full explanation for the parents' motivations. Of all the movies on my list, to me, this most effectively communicated what it might be like to feel the cruelty and terror of a hostage situation.
Well, I love that crazy movie, so I love that it's your number one. And of course, everyone listening has seen it. It was a Film Spotting Golden Brick winner, I believe, the second year of the Film Spotting Golden Brick. Wouldn't work for me in this context just because, again, of that kind of bargaining thing is not really there. They're not looking to get anything out of this, the parents, other than control.
Or are they?
As you said. Well, yeah, but it's primarily control, I think, and maybe, ultimately, protection. Maybe they think they're actually helping their kids.
That's one possibility.
My number one hostage movie, well, I'm going really conventional here, Josh, and it is a movie I'm guessing you probably considered but maybe left off because it's been talked about recently on the show. I don't care. I think it has to be the number one, and it's one of the best all-time, if not the best all-time, Hollywood action movie, Die Hard, starring, of course, Bruce Willis as John McClane. Yes, we did give it the Sacred Cow treatment on episode number 430. That happened just this past January, so I will point people to that discussion. We'll link to it in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net if you want to hear it. But the big thing we focused on in that Sacred Cow discussion was, how did we come to it this time, neither of us having really seen it since it came out in the late 80s? Was it just a case of a really good, well-made action movie, or is there something a little bit more going on? And what we both realized is there really kind of is a little bit more going on. That is a movie that is slyly satirical. It really does seem to take kind of American jingoism and machismo in its sights and plays with that a little bit. And one of the ways it plays with it is in McClane's character, in the way he kind of always seems like he's overdoing it a little bit to try to be extra tough and extra macho. And by the end of the film, what he has to learn to be able to do is recognize that he's actually at fault for things and has to say he's sorry to his wife. I mean, that's really the emotional climax of this film, ultimately, which is not something I really was tuned into when I saw it when I was in my early teens. So we could go on and on about Hans Gruber and how I think Alan Rickman probably kind of defined the archetypal villain in a lot of these action movies, the archetypal hostage taker. But that was another little twist I liked as well, as we focus on some of the different types of hostage takers in these movies. He's a guy who, as it turns out, really doesn't care about the hostages at all. It's all just a big ruse. He has other things on his mind, just going the conventional route. He's really just greedy and wants a lot of money. So another reason why that one stood out to me. Die Hard had to be my number one.
But I need the code key because I am interested in the $640 million in negotiable bearer bonds that you have locked in your vault, and the computer controls the vault.
I want money. What kind of terrorist are you?
Who said we were terrorists?
Certainly an honorable mention for me, but yeah, I left it off because we had discussed it recently. I'd also include as an honorable mention another action movie, really good action movie, I feel, Speed and Fargo. You mentioned at the top that was an honorable mention. Another Pantheon pick besides Dog Day Afternoon would be Blue Velvet. There's a little element of it there, I think. And besides Disney's Beauty and the Beast, I think you have to also consider Jean Cocteau's original Beauty and the Beast. That version plays with hostage taking. And a couple more here. Key Largo, another Bogart film. And Pain and Gain, which is still holding a spot in my 2013 top 10. It all turns on taking a hostage.
Man, which I am really still dreading having to seek
out. Don't go into it that way now,
before our January rap party. I'm going to go in with an open mind, Josh. I promise. Well, of course, if Blue Velvet did qualify, even if it did qualify, Josh, as a hostage movie, it's in the Film Spotting Pantheon.
Right, exactly. That's why I left it off.
Okay, so an honorable mention for you. The only one for me, I'm sure I could come up with others. There are a lot of really good hostage movies. The only one I'm going to mention briefly that I did consider, in addition to the ones I excluded, like Fargo, would be The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. And I like the original quite a bit, and I do like the original better than the Tony Scott version. But the original one with Robert Shaw and, of course, Walter Matthau, that's where I'm going. Those are our top five hostage movies. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Carrie, the remake, directed by Kimberly Pierce of Boys Don't Cry fame. Chloe Grace Moretz stars as Carrie White. Julianne Moore in the role made famous by Piper Laurie as her crazy mom.
Talk about trying to step into an iconic performance.
True, but you know what? Julianne Moore can probably pull it off. I'll tell you who can't pull it off and talk about not going in with an open mind. Chloe Grace Moretz.
Yeah,
she is no Sissy Spacek. And I dread it every time even the trailer comes on, Josh. Escape Plan. This is the new film starring Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Amy Ryan, of all people. Amy Ryan. Well,
how are you going to complete that trio? Of course you need Amy Ryan.
Right. Stallone is a structural engineer. He designs an escape-proof prison that he has to escape from when he's framed and incarcerated in a prison. Yes, right. He designed.
This isn't for real.
It is real. And Matt Singer from Film Spotting SVU is ready to party like it's 1985. He's doing it right now, just hearing that description.
He's already seen it 10 yours, times. Matt.
He's
all
seen
yours.
It 10 times and recorded a DVD commentary. Out in limited release, there's a lot of options. We're only going to highlight a couple here. The Fifth Estate, starring who, Josh?
I believe that would be The Batch.
The Batch. Benedict Cumberbatch as Julian Assange. And also out, 12 Years a Slave. A lot of buzz coming out of the Toronto International Film Festival, directed by Steve McQueen, who made the brilliant film Hunger and the movie Shame. It stars Chiwetel Ejiofor, Brad Pitt, and my guy, Michael Fassbender. Next week, it's our Halloween show, Josh. We are going to devote our next Sacred Cow discussion to William Friedkin's 1973, don't call it a horror film classic, The Exorcist.
Not Bachelor Party.
Not Bachelor Party. I will twist your arm and convince you to do that at a later date. It's the 40th anniversary, can you believe that, of The Exorcist. We'll also get to the fourth film in our Korean auteurs marathon, the 2008 thriller The Chaser from Na Hong Jin. And we'll also share our Halloween 2012 top five. We'll go back and revisit that, where Michael Phillips helped us count down our top five most terrifying characters.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music was from Richard Buckner, came from his new album, Surrounded. You can find more information at richardbuckner.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.